This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, the recession and militarism with Vijay Prasad. But first, America's 4D economy, from deficit deals to double-dip recession.
Well, now we're going to continue to look at, the economy. Well, first, we were frightened by politicians proclaiming that the economic ceiling will fall in if the deficit wasn't cut by trillions. Then the politicians insisted that in order to raise the debt ceiling, we needed to endure, hey, guess what? Cuts on our backs of our vital services. But the U.S. manufacturing sector has collapsed. The public sector is hemorrhaging jobs, and consumer spending is plunging, and the jobs that were created may have just kept pace with the recent unemployment figures, preventing them from shooting up a little, but they were hardly enough to keep pace with those about to enter the workforce.
And they certainly don't affect those living on extended unemployment benefits, those who simply can't find work, and those who are underemployed and really can't support their families. The real economy is accelerating its slide toward a double-dip recession, and the deficit reduction deal approved by Congress will make it harder to fight the coming re-recession. Now America's 4D economy, from deficit deals to double-dip recession, with Jack Rasmus, author of Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. Yeah, it hurts.
Well, Jack, it's nice to have you back. The last time we did, we were in a state of angst over the attack on our pension system. It just doesn't stop going on. Help put this in some perspective for us. I barely know where to start.
As we know, the stock market took a big dive, and that is not the end of the story. We're going to see more collapse in stocks and asset prices. And as you indicated in your comments, not about debt ceilings and deficits. They passed that, and the markets kind of yawned. But then immediately the next day we had, a collapse in consumption, manufacturing activity, 5 full percentage points. Back down to stagnation, and not just in the U.S., but globally, manufacturing slowing down everywhere around the world, which means export sales are going to slow in the United States, and that's been the only place where they've created a few jobs, and that's about to come to an end. And then the next day, consumption, 70% of the economy, went into the negative zone for the first time since 2009 again, and that really sent the markets down. It stabilized a little bit toward the end of the week, and of course everybody was worrying when the other foot was going to, shoe was going to fall. But this rating thing by S&P just precipitated what people are already aware of in the real economy, and that is there are no jobs being created. In fact, we haven't really come off the floor in terms of job creation since the bottom of the recession in June 2009. We've been bouncing along the bottom as far as jobs. In the summer of 2010, jobs started collapsing again. We went negative, several hundred thousand jobs lost. And that precipitated another policy response in the fall of last year. The Federal Reserve pumped another $600 billion into the economy. After, by the way, it had pumped $9 trillion into bailing out the banks, according to its report of July 2010, $9 trillion we spent bailing out the banks, including $1 trillion the Fed spent bailing out foreign banks. But all we could come up with is a couple of tens of billions to bail out 10 million U.S. homeowners in foreclosure. We'll spend tens of trillions for the banks, but only tens of billions for homeowners. Housing is in a triple dip. That's never recovered. That's at comparable levels of collapse to the 1930s, and no light at the end of the tunnel. Prices are continuing to fall. And now, of course, we've got a triple dip occurring in the jobs market. You mentioned the 117,000 jobs last month created. You need about 150 just to keep even with new entrants into the labor force. But, you know, the Labor Department has two reports on jobs. What you've got is the press and policymakers cherry-picking the best of the two reports. If you look at the other report, not the payroll report, but what's called the current population survey, that registered last month 198,000 fewer jobs. Not much talk about that one, is it? But see, that one picks up the small business and the self-employed job loss, whereas the payroll report does not. And if you look at the CPS report, last 4 months, it's down 901,000 jobs. I've been predicting this since earlier this year, that double dip was coming, and published articles and on my blog, jackrasmus.com. You know, I could see what was happening in the jobs market, and you simply cannot get a recovery without getting a recovery in jobs. And by the way, you will not solve the deficit problem without creating jobs. You cannot austerity your way out of this crisis. You cannot get out of this crisis by cutting spending and cutting taxes for businesses. You know, we've mostly cut taxes for businesses. Even Obama, half of his program in 2009 was tax cuts, most of that for business. And then we extended the Bush tax cuts by another $400 billion. So that's, you know, about $1 trillion in tax cuts for businesses, and we get nothing for it. That's because cutting taxes in a downturn in a crisis like this just ends up with businesses hoarding the money. And that's exactly what they're doing. Big businesses are sitting on a cash hoard of $2 trillion. They're not spending it to create jobs in the U.S. You know, conservatives will say, oh, that's because business confidence and regulations and all this. Well, that's nonsense. They're not spending it because they're not going to hire people when people can't afford to buy their products. How can you expect business to expand and add people when they got a warehouse full of stuff now and no one can afford to buy it?
Jack, I want to interrupt for just a second just to move it forward into the phase of what can we do about this. And I know that you are critical of a lot of the liberal economists in terms of whether traditional stimulus packages are enough. We should be so lucky to get even that, though. So if you could break it down in terms of the traditional liberal response, which is stimulus packages, which, again, will never get past the Republicans at this point, and whether that's even enough and whether we need something more than that.
Well, I've been saying for a long time that the Obama stimulus was two great problems with it. This is the $800 billion and then some supplemental stuff last year. Two great problems. The first problem is that it's heavily tax cut, business tax cut oriented. So forget that. Write that off. That's half. The spending side of it was not spending designed to create jobs. It was spending to subsidize state and local governments by $264 billion and to extend unemployment insurance and COBRA and so forth. All of that is fine, but it doesn't create jobs. So you must spend. We must have a massive 21st century Works Progress Administration type program in order to create jobs. If you create the jobs, you'll create tax base that will reduce the deficit. Corporations are sitting on trillions of dollars offshore. They're not bringing them back. They're not paying their taxes. The wealthy individuals have parked about $4 trillion offshore in tax shelters. You know, there's no shortage of available money to finance jobs in a WPA-like program. It's just that it's all being held at the top, and the Obama administration is afraid to go after it. You don't have to cut deficits. You can tax the rich and the corporations, and you can grow out of this crisis. But unless you do that, nothing's going to happen.
Well, perhaps you can continue to move forward with this thought, demonstrate how we can prevent the onset of depression. You mentioned massive job creation programs, and you've also, in your book, mentioned the nationalization of the mortgage and consumer credit markets and new banking and tax structures. Pick up on that, you know, flesh that out for us.
You know, we've never had a recovery from a crisis without a recovery of housing. So you've got to do something about the housing sector. You've got to get it going again. The banks won't loan money. We've had a decline in lending to small businesses and to mortgage consumers. since the bottom of this recession, so-called. Now, what you need to do is something we did in the 30s. That was called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. What you need is a special government agency that will go in there and will simply buy up these mortgages, the subprimes and the people who are underwater, you know, 17 million underwater, and reset the principal and the interest and own the mortgages. You can pay off the investors 25 cents on the dollar as they did in the 30s and say, go away, okay? But going forward, you have to have a new kind of banking structure. You know, the problem is we got these big speculators and hedge funds and commercial banks and so forth that are dragging down the rest of the economy. We have to set up a utility banking system in this country where loans are made to small businesses and to homeowners and so forth on a cost-of-money-only basis. Take the profit out of this, because that sector of the economy is too important to let the big bankers and speculators bring it down every time they take these risks and get out of hand. Let them go and deal with their mergers, acquisitions, and private equity and all that stuff. Not create a wall like we did in the 30s with Glass-Steagall. We got to create a moat between the consumer side of banking and the speculative side of banking. So we need a whole new kind of banking system going forward here, roughly along the lines that I've described. We need to turn the tax structure back on its feet. We've turned it since Reagan upside down. You know, the typical top 1% person pays about the effective federal tax rate of about 16%. We got to return that to about 40, 50%. Corporations once paid 30% of all federal tax revenue. Today, provide 6% of federal tax revenue. You've got hedge fund managers making billions of dollars paying more taxes than their secretaries. I mean, this thing has gotten totally out of control, totally out of whack, and we need a revolution in the tax structure just as we need a revolution in the banking structure. And by that, I mean fundamentally restructuring those sectors of the economy. And we got to do something about reversing this terrible income shift over the last 30 years. You know, the top wealthiest 1% households once in 1978 had 8 to 9% of the total income. Today they got 25%. That's, by the way, exactly what they had in 1929. So when your income gets all out of whack like that, income distribution, you're just asking for depressions and trouble. And that's exactly where we're headed. In my book, Epic Recession, I said, this is not a normal decline, and it's not over. Back in end of 2009, when I predicted the double dip coming back then, this is a financial-induced collapse in which the system itself has become fragile, both consumers fragile, financial fragility, and now public balance sheet fragility. And you cannot get out of this with normal fiscal monetary policies. Neither the small magnitudes of the policies that we've spent here, but more important, the targeting, the composition of the spending is all wrong. It's not on jobs. It's not bailing out homeowners. And it's not really putting our state and local governments back on their feet. Those three areas have to be focused upon. But instead, what we're doing, we're trying to austerity our way out of this crisis, which is impossible. Austerity will make the deficits worse.
And if you want to put more meat on the skeleton that was just provided for us as a foundation for rebuilding the economy, you should read Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression by Jack Rasmus. It is always a pleasure to have you with us, even under these awful circumstances and economic times. And I think we have to give a round shout out, all of us, to our sisters and brothers on the Verizon picket line.
Exactly.
We will have more on that next week for sure.
Can go over to some of the lines, some of the demonstrations at Verizon headquarters and say, hello, I'm with you. Give a shout out to them because they're fighting their fight, which is our fight. And now we move to Vijay Prasad, who is the George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. At a recent lecture at New York City's Riverside Church, Prasad explored the boom and bust of the capitalist cycle. Even in boom years, people do not have enough to spend, so the economy declines. But if the people are not strong, then capitalism resists spending for social services, preferring to stimulate the economy with spending on domestic repression and war. Prasad places this in the context of globalization and the present protests around the world, which began in Tunisia.
Good evening, comrades. Capitalism is like a roller coaster. The dynamism of ruthless profit pushes against the constraints of humanity and technology to produce the boom years. But the very pressure of cutting wages and substituting machines for people creates unruly competition, and vast masses of humanity have not enough money in hand to buy the goods. And the piles of wasted goods tempers the enthusiasm of capital to make more. We enter the bust years. Pressures from workers and the discovery of the dangers of the bust years leads to the idea that the state must spend taxed money or borrowed money to stimulate the economy. Where social democracy is stronger, the money was spent on the social side of things, on healthcare, on education, on public transportation, on public parks, on the social wages that both revved up the stalled economy and provided the basis for social solidarity. Such a social democratic path provided the objective basis for socialism. People might take pleasure in social interchange, in mutual care, and in solicitude. This was not capital's preferred path. It has a harsher tendency. In the United States, from the late 19th century to the present, spending on the social side of the ledger has not gone above 15% of the gross domestic product. Here, the government has conducted its counter-cyclical spending not on the social side, but on the side of repression, on the international armed forces and the domestic armed forces, on the military and on the police. You get the stimulus you need, but what you don't get is the objective basis for social solidarity. Military and police hierarchies are strengthened, and horizontal social life is eroded. If this was not bad enough, over the past 30 years, another social process has added to the grief of normal militarism, what we call globalization. The debt crisis in the global south sent billions of dollars into the banks of the North. These banks and their industrial counterparts decided to finance their factories outside the high-wage zones of the North. Wages are high in the United States comparatively because all our basic needs have been privatized. As individuals and families, we are responsible for healthcare, education, transportation, and insurance. If we don't earn enough, we don't survive. That is what makes our labor so expensive. If the rich were taxed, and if services came to us through the state, we could receive lower wages and produce goods at a much more competitive rate. But that is not so. Instead, the state encouraged firms to take their industrial capital to zones of cheaper labor, making more and more people in the United States utterly disposable, redundant to the changed economy. It is to control them, to corral them, that the prison industrial complex grew and that the police forces expanded. The state has no further use for its people. It can only offer incarceration of one kind or another. Everybody dies, but not everybody lives. Banks also turned their accumulated capital into financial wizardry. Mathematics is the lead science, not chemistry, physics, or biology. Things are no longer made for profits to be harnessed. It is enough to manipulate numbers. Finance makes its own maps, It has its own atlas. Money makes wide detours around the human imagination. Disposable people are needed to sign the forms for no money down payments. And then they are needed to take the blame for the system's torrents. Their hopes and dreams, their visions and needs are not at the center of things. Some believe that the world will end on Saturday. Our framework is not so random, so catastrophic. I also believe in the end times. In the end time for capitalism, a system rooted in the destruction. A system rooted in the destruction of the human spirit. Democracy is our prejudice, but it does not fully exist yet. It is an idea. It provides space for action, but it has not yet been incarnated fully. The secular rapture will be the day when democracy comes into its own. Democracy makes its appearance in the streets of Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab revolt. They follow events in Latin America, from the Venezuelan Caracazo of 1989 to the Bolivian gas wars in 2003-2005. They follow, as well, the events in the rest of Africa, from the unrest over the Kenyan elections of 2007-08 to the Enough is Enough protests in Nigeria last year. The people know or feel this idea of democracy, and they have decided to enact it on their streets. For them, the idea is no longer simply a slogan. The script is being read out in public. And furthermore, this is a socialist idea, for at its depth is a scream for popular control over institutions, not simply for a transference of power from one section of the elite to another. Egypt's pharaonic state had a sophisticated security apparatus with a necklace of prisons around Cairo itself. The upsurge has taken aim at these prisons, but it is not enough for them to target the prisons. These are an emblem of a system that relied upon incarceration for its stability and its treasury. The U.S. Treasury, it gave a bursary of $3 billion per year, and that was designed to contain dissent among the Egyptian people and to keep in place the so-called peace deal with Israel. To truly end the security state, the people had to recapture their politics and their economics and wash the toxicity out of their society. An early indication of this total view was the strikes by the Suez workers and the threat to close down the Suez Canal. That would be a truly internationalist gesture, with their hands on the lever of a tenth of the world's trade. Every country gets the fascism it deserves, and so too does it get its revolutionary task. The Arab revolt is taking care of its various confounding structures. It is their job. The help we can give them is to begin the long process of dismantling the imperial tentacles. We must dismantle the imperial tentacles, including ending the subsidy given to the Egyptian army as a bribe on behalf of Israel. Our job is not to run their revolution. Our job is to lift the U.S. boot from the neck of the Arab people. That U.S. boot goes down in the name of justice and peace, in the name of humanitarian intervention. By temperament, George W. Bush destroyed this permission to bomb. He was too brash, too unable to mask raw force behind sweet words. Barack Obama is more sophisticated. He has rehabilitated humanitarian intervention, which is the window dressing that imperialism needs to counter our wider ideas and aspirations for democracy. When the empire acts, it is never on the side of the good. Historians go back and find that it is hard to rehabilitate the war aims. Negotiations are on to bring the Taliban back to authority in Kabul. So where is now the concern for the Afghan woman? So too with Libya, where the neoliberals like Mahmoud Jibril and Shokri Ghanem will be handed the keys to the country, absent erratic and ruthless Gaddafi. Much the same in Haiti. The boot does not bring justice, which is the collateral damage of imperialism. The neoliberal project of the United States has come undone in the economic sphere. But that project was never about economics alone. It had its limits, such as the reliance by the United States on others to buy its substantial debt. The way to ensure that this debt is covered is by political pressure, by military force. The Chinese, Saudis, Europeans, and others continue to buy the U.S. bills because they recognize the dollar as the planet's main currency, and they allow the United States to protect their interest with its substantial military force. If domestic prisons and prison-like conditions maintain an immoral peace inside the country, the planetary reach of the U.S. war machine maintains power for the global elite against humanity. Maps point to places where life is evil now: Afghanistan, Libya, Bahrain, Gaza, and Detroit. The military aspect of neoliberalism is alive and well. We might not have the responsibility for the way things turn out in Egypt, but we are certainly responsible for the militarism that keeps us afloat. Our job is to build our movement, to incarnate democracy in our spaces. We live in freedom by necessity. We must reshape our world. We must love one another or die. Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.